gravitational field, the path of a light ray on the diagram is a line at a 45-degree angle to the vertical. However, nearer the star, the curvature of space-time produced by the mass of the star will change the paths of the light rays and cause them to be at a smaller angle to the vertical. Massive stars will burn their hydrogen into helium much faster than the Sun does. This means they can run out of hydrogen in as little as a few hundred million years. After that, such stars face a crisis. They can burn their helium into heavier elements such as carbon and oxygen, but these nuclear reactions don't release much energy, so the stars lose heat and the thermal pressure that supports them against gravity. Therefore, they begin to get smaller. If they are more than about twice the mass of the Sun, the pressure will never be sufficient to stop the contraction. They'll collapse to zero size and infinite density to form what is called a singularity. In the diagram of time against distance from the center, as a star shrinks, the paths of light rays from its surface will start out at smaller and smaller angles to the vertical. When the star reaches a certain critical radius, the path will be vertical on the diagram, which means that the light will hover at a constant distance from the center of the star, never getting away. This critical path of light will sweep out a surface called the event horizon, which separates the region of space-time from which light can escape from the region from which it can't. Any light emitted by the star after it passes the event horizon will be bent back inward by the curvature of space-time. The star will have become one of Mitchell's dark stars, or as we say now, a black hole. How can you detect a black hole if no light can get out of it? The answer is that a black hole still exerts the same gravitational pull on neighboring objects as did the body that collapsed. If the Sun were a black hole and had managed to become one without losing any of its mass, the planets would still orbit as they do now. One way of searching for a black hole is therefore to look for matter that is orbiting what seems to be an unseen, compact, massive object. A number of such systems have been observed. Perhaps the most impressive are the giant black holes that occur in the centers of galaxies and quasars. The properties of black holes that have been discussed thus far don't raise any great problems with determinism. Time will come to an end for an astronaut who falls into a black hole and hits the singularity. However, in general relativity, one is free to measure time at different rates in different places. One could, therefore, speed up the astronaut's watch as he or she approached the singularity so that it still registered an infinite interval of time. On the time and distance diagram, the surfaces of constant values of this new time would be all crowded together at the center, below the point where the singularity appeared. But they would agree with the usual measure of time in the nearly flat space-time far away from the black hole. One could use this time in the Schrödinger equation and calculate the wave function at later times if one knew it initially. Thus, one still has determinism. It's worth noting, however, that at late times, part of the wave function is inside the black hole, where it can't be observed by someone outside. Thus, an observer who is sensible enough not to fall into a black hole can't run the Schrödinger equation backward and calculate the wave function at early times. To do that, he or she would need to know the part of the wave function that's inside the black hole. This contains the information about what fell into the hole. This is potentially a very large amount of information because a black hole of a given mass and rate of rotation can be formed from a very large number of different collections of particles. A black hole does not depend on the nature of the body that had collapsed to form it. John Wheeler called this result, "A black hole has no hair." For the French, this just confirmed their suspicions. The difficulty with determinism arose when I discovered that black holes aren't completely black. As we saw in Chapter 2, quantum theory means that fields can't be exactly zero, even in what is called the vacuum. If they were zero, they would have both an exact value or position at zero and an exact rate of change or velocity that was also zero. This would be a violation of the uncertainty principle, which says that the position and velocity can't both be well defined. All fields must instead have a certain amount of what are called vacuum fluctuations. in the same way that the pendulum in Chapter 2 had to have zero-point fluctuations. Vacuum fluctuations can be interpreted in several ways that seem different, but are in fact mathematically equivalent. From a positivist viewpoint, one is free to use whatever picture is most useful for the problem in question. In this case, it's helpful to think of vacuum fluctuations as pairs of virtual particles that appear together at some point of space-time, move apart and come back together, and annihilate each other. Virtual means that these particles can't be observed directly, but their indirect effects can be measured, and they agree with theoretical predictions to a remarkable degree of accuracy. If a black hole is present, one member of a pair of particles may fall into the black hole, leaving the other member free to escape to infinity. To someone far from the black hole, the escaping particles appear to have been radiated by the black hole. The spectrum of a black hole is exactly what we would expect from a hot body with a temperature proportional to the gravitational field on the horizon, the boundary of the black hole. In other words, the temperature of a black hole depends on its size. A black hole of a few solar masses would have a temperature of about a millionth of a degree above absolute zero, and a larger black hole would have an even lower temperature. Thus, any quantum radiation from such black holes would be utterly swamped by the 2.7 minus degree radiation left over from the hot Big Bang, the cosmic background radiation that we discussed in Chapter 2. It would be possible to detect the radiation from much smaller and hotter black holes, but there don't seem to be many of them around. That's a pity. If one were discovered, I would get a Nobel Prize. However, we have indirect observational evidence for this radiation, and that evidence comes from the early universe. As described in Chapter 3, it's thought that very early in its history, the universe went through an inflationary period, during which it expanded at an ever-increasing rate. The expansion during this period would have been so rapid that some objects would be too distant from us for their light ever to reach us. The universe would have expanded too much and too rapidly while that light was traveling toward us. Thus, there would be an horizon in the universe like the horizon of a black hole, separating the region from which light can reach us and the region from which it can't. Very similar arguments show that there should be thermal radiation from this horizon, as there is from a black hole horizon. In thermal radiation, we've learned to expect a characteristic spectrum of density fluctuations. In this case, these density fluctuations would have expanded with the universe. When their length scale became longer than the size of the event horizon, they would have become frozen in, so that we can observe them today as small variations in the temperature of the cosmic background radiation left over from the early universe. The observations of those variations agree with the predictions of thermal fluctuations with remarkable accuracy. Even if the observational evidence for black hole radiation is a bit indirect, everyone who has studied the problem agrees it must occur in order to be consistent with our other observationally tested theories. This has important implications for determinism. The radiation from a black hole will carry away energy, which must mean that the black hole will lose mass and get smaller. In turn, this will mean that its temperature will rise and the rate of radiation will increase. Eventually, the black hole will get down to zero mass. We don't know how to calculate what happens at this point, but the only natural, reasonable outcome would seem to be that the black hole disappears completely. So what happens then to the part of the wave function inside the black hole and the information it contains about what had fallen into the black hole? The first guess might be that this part of the wave function and the information it carries would emerge when the black hole finally disappears. However, information can't be carried for free, as one realizes when one gets a telephone bill. Information requires energy to carry it, and there's very little energy left in the final stages of a black hole. The only plausible way the information inside could get out would be if it emerged continuously with the radiation rather than waiting for this final stage. However, according to the picture of one member of a virtual particle pair falling in and the other member escaping, one wouldn't expect the escaping particle to be related to what fell in or to carry away information about it. So the only answer would seem to be that the information in the part of the wave function inside the black hole gets lost. Such loss of information would have important implications for determinism. To start with, we've noted that even if you knew the wave function after the black hole disappeared, you could not run the Schrödinger equation backward and calculate what the wave function was before the black hole formed. What that was would depend in part on the bit of the wave function that got lost in the black hole. We're used to thinking we can know the past exactly. However, if information gets lost in black holes, this is not the case. Anything could have happened. In general, however, people such as astrologers and those who consult them are more interested in predicting the future than in retrodicting the past. At first glance, it might seem that the loss of part of the wave function down the black hole would not prevent us from predicting the wave function outside the black hole. But it turns out that this loss does interfere with such a prediction, as we can see when we consider a thought experiment proposed by Einstein, Boris Podolsky, and Nathan Rosen in the 1930s. Imagine that a radioactive atom decays and sends out two particles in opposite directions and with opposite spins. An observer, who looks only at one particle, can't predict whether it will be spinning to the right or left. But if the observer measures it to be spinning to the right, then he or she can predict with certainty that the other particle will be spinning to the left, and vice versa. Einstein thought that this proved that quantum theory was ridiculous. The other particle might be at the other side of the galaxy by now, yet one would instantaneously know which way it was spinning. However, most other scientists agreed that it was Einstein who was confused, not quantum theory. The Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen thought experiment doesn't show that one is able to send information faster than light. That would be the ridiculous part. One can't choose that one's own particle will be measured to be spinning to the right, so one can't prescribe that the distant observer's particle should be spinning to the left. In fact, this thought experiment is exactly what happens with black hole radiation. The virtual particle pair will have a wave function that predicts the two members will definitely have opposite spins. What we would like to do is predict the spin and wave function of the outgoing particle, which we could do if we could observe the particle that's fallen in. But that particle is now inside the black hole, where its spin and wave function can't be measured. Because of this, it's not possible to predict the spin or the wave function of the particle that escapes. It can have different spins and different wave functions with various probabilities, but it doesn't have a unique spin or wave function. Thus it would seem that our power to predict the future would be further reduced. The classical idea of Laplace, that one could predict both the positions and velocities of particles, had to be modified when the uncertainty principle showed that one couldn't accurately measure both positions and velocities. However, one could still measure the wave function and use the Schrödinger equation to predict what it should be in the future. This would allow one to predict with certainty one combination of position and velocity, which is half of what one could predict according to Laplace's ideas. We can predict with certainty that the particles have opposite spins. But if one particle falls into the black hole, there is no prediction we can make with certainty about the remaining particle. This means that there isn't any measurement outside the black hole that can be predicted with certainty. Our ability to make definite predictions would be reduced to zero. So, maybe astrology is no worse at predicting the future than the laws of science. Many physicists didn't like this reduction in determinism, and therefore suggested that information about what is inside can somehow get out of a black hole. For years, it was just a pious hope that some way to save the information would be found. But in 1996, Andrew Stominger and Kumrun Wafa made an important advance. They chose to regard a black hole as being made up of a number of building blocks called P-brains. Recall that one way of thinking about P-brains is as sheets that move through the three dimensions of space and also through seven extra dimensions that we don't notice. In certain cases, one can show that the number of waves on the P-brains is the same as the amount of information one would expect the black hole to contain. If particles hit the P-brains, they excite extra waves on the brains. Similarly, if waves moving in different directions on the pea brains come together at some point, they can create a peak so great that a bit of the pea brain breaks away and goes off as a particle. Thus, the pea brains can absorb and emit particles like black holes. One can regard the pea brains as an effective theory. That is, while we don't need to believe that there are actually little sheets moving through a flat space-time, black holes can behave as if they were made up of such sheets. It's like water, which is made up of billions and billions of H2O molecules with complicated interactions. But a smooth fluid is a very good effective model. The mathematical model of black holes as made of pea brains gives results similar to the virtual particle pair picture described earlier. Thus, from a positivist viewpoint, it's an equally good model, at least for certain classes of black hole. For these classes, the pea brain model predicts exactly the same rate of emission that the virtual particle pair model predicts. However, there is one important difference. In the pea brain model, information about what falls into the black hole will be stored in the wave function for the waves on the pea brains. The pea brains are regarded as sheets in flat space-time, and for that reason, time will flow forward smoothly. The paths of light rays won't be bent, and the information in the waves won't be lost. Instead, the information will eventually emerge from the black hole in the radiation from the pea brains. Thus, according to the pea brain model, we can use the Schrödinger equation to calculate what the wave function will be at later times. Nothing will get lost, and time will roll smoothly on. We will have complete determinism in the quantum sense. So, which of these pictures is correct? Does part of the wave function get lost down black holes, or does all the information get out again, as the pea brain model suggests? This is one of the outstanding questions in theoretical physics today. Many people believe that recent work shows that information is not lost. The world is safe and predictable, and nothing unexpected will happen. But it's not clear. If one takes Einstein's general theory of relativity seriously, one must allow the possibility that space-time ties itself in a knot and information gets lost in the folds. Chapter 5. Protecting the Past. Is time travel possible? Could an advanced civilization go back and change the past? My friend and colleague, Kip Thorne, with whom I've had a number of bets, is not one to follow the accepted line in physics just because everyone else does. This has led him to have the courage to be the first serious scientist to discuss time travel as a practical possibility. It is tricky to speculate openly about time travel. One risks either an outcry at the waste of public money being spent on something so ridiculous, or a demand that the research be classified for military purposes. After all, how could we protect ourselves against someone with a time machine? They might change history and rule the world. There are only a very few of us foolhardy enough to work on a subject that is so politically incorrect in physics circles. We disguise the fact by using technical terms that are code for time travel. The basis of all modern discussions of time travel is Einstein's general theory of relativity. As we've seen in earlier chapters, the Einstein equations made space and time dynamic by describing how they were curved and distorted by the matter and energy in the universe. In general relativity, someone's personal time, as measured by their wristwatch, would always increase, just as it did in Newtonian theory or the flat space-time of special relativity. But there was now the possibility that space-time could be warped so much that you could go off in a spaceship and come back before you set out. One way this could happen is if there were wormholes, tubes of space-time mentioned in Chapter 4 that connect different regions of space and time. The idea is that you steer your spaceship into one mouth of the wormhole and come out of the other mouth in a different place and at a different time. Wormholes, if they exist, would be the solution to the speed limit problem in space. It would take tens of thousands of years to cross the galaxy in a spaceship that travelled at less than the speed of light, as relativity demands. But you might go through a wormhole to the other side of the galaxy and be back in time for dinner. However, one can show that if wormholes exist, You could also use them to get back before you set out. So you might think that you could do something like blowing up the rocket on its launch pad to prevent your setting out in the first place. This is a variation of the grandfather paradox. What happens if you go back and kill your grandfather before your father was conceived? Of course, this is a paradox only if you believe you have free will to do what you like when you go back in time. This book will not go into a philosophical discussion of free will. Instead, it'll concentrate on whether the laws of physics allow space-time to be so warped that a macroscopic body, such as a spaceship, can return to its own past. According to Einstein's theory, a spaceship necessarily travels at less than the local speed of light and follows what's called a time-like path through space-time. Thus, one can formulate the question in technical terms: does space-time admit time-like curves that are closed, that is, that return to their starting point again and again? I shall refer to such paths as time loops. There are three levels on which we can try to answer this question. The first is Einstein's general theory of relativity, which assumes that the universe has a well-defined history without any uncertainty. For this classical theory, we have a fairly complete picture. However, as we've seen, this theory can't be quite right because we observe that matter is subject to uncertainty and quantum fluctuations. We can therefore ask the question about time travel on a second level, that of semi-classical theory. In this, we consider matter to behave according to quantum theory, with uncertainty and quantum fluctuations, but space-time to be well-defined and classical. Here, the picture is less complete, but at least we have some idea of how to proceed. Finally, there is the full quantum theory of gravity, whatever that may be. In this theory, where not just matter, but also time and space themselves are uncertain and fluctuate, it's not even clear how to pose the question of whether time travel is possible. Maybe the best we can do is to ask how people in regions where space-time is nearly classical and free from uncertainty would interpret their measurements. Would they think that time travel had taken place in regions of strong gravity and large quantum fluctuations? To start with the classical theory, the flat space-time of special relativity, relativity without gravity, doesn't allow time travel, nor do the curved space-times that were known early on. It was therefore a great shock to Einstein when, in 1949, Kurt Gödel, of Gödel's theorem, discovered a space-time that was a universe full of rotating matter, with time loops through every point. Gödel's incompleteness theorem. In 1931, the mathematician Kurt Gödel proved his famous incompleteness theorem about the nature of mathematics. The theorem states that within any formal system of axioms, such as present-day mathematics, questions always persist that can neither be proved or disproved on the basis of the axioms that define the system. In other words, Gödel showed that there are problems that cannot be solved by any set of rules or procedures. Gödel's theorem set fundamental limits on mathematics. It came as a great shock to the scientific community, since it overthrew the widespread belief that mathematics was a coherent and complete system based on a single logical foundation. Gödel's theorem, together with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and chaos theory, form a core set of limitations to scientific knowledge that came to be appreciated only during the 20th century. The Gödel solution required a cosmological constant, which may or may not exist in nature. But other solutions were subsequently found without a cosmological constant. A particularly interesting case is one in which two cosmic strings move at high speed past each other. Cosmic strings. Cosmic strings are long, heavy objects with a tiny cross-section that may have been produced during the early stages of the universe. Once cosmic strings formed, they were further stretched by the expansion of the universe, and by now a single cosmic string could cross over the entire length of our observable universe. The occurrence of cosmic strings is suggested by modern theories of particles, which predict that in the hot, early stages of the universe, matter was in a symmetric phase, much like liquid water, which is symmetrical, the same at every point in every direction, rather than like ice crystals, which have a discrete structure. When the universe cooled, the symmetry of the early phase could have been broken in different ways in distant regions. Consequently, the cosmic matter would have settled into different ground states in those regions. Cosmic strings are the configurations of matter at the boundaries between these regions. Their formation was therefore an inevitable consequence of the fact that different regions could not agree on their ground states. Cosmic strings should not be confused with the strings of string theory, though they are not entirely unrelated. They're objects with length, but a tiny cross-section. Their occurrence is predicted in some theories of elementary particles. The space-time outside a single cosmic string is flat. However, it's flat space-time with a wedge cut out, with the sharp end of the wedge at the string. It's like a cone. Take a large circle of paper and cut out a segment like a slice of pie, a wedge with its corner at the center of the circle. Then discard the piece you've cut out and glue the cut edges of the remaining piece together so that you have a cone. This represents the space-time in which the cosmic string exists. Notice that because the surface of the cone is the same flat sheet of paper with which you started, minus the wedge, you can still call it flat, except at the apex. You can recognize that there is curvature at the apex by the fact that a circle round the apex has a smaller circumference than a circle drawn at the same distance round the center of the original round sheet of paper. In other words, a circle round the apex is shorter than one would expect for a circle of that radius in flat space because of the missing segment. Similarly, in the case of a cosmic string, the wedge that is removed from flat space-time shortens circles round the string but doesn't affect time or distances along the string. This means that the space-time around a single cosmic string doesn't contain any time loops, so it's not possible to travel into the past. However, if there's a second cosmic string that is moving relative to the first, its time direction will be a combination of the time and space directions of the first. This means that the wedge that is cut out for the second string will shorten both distances in space and time intervals as seen by someone moving with the first string. If the cosmic strings are moving at nearly the speed of light relative to each other, the saving of time going around both strings can be so great that one arrives back before one set out. In other words, there are time loops that one can follow to travel into the past. The cosmic string space-time contains matter that has positive energy density and is consistent with the physics we know. However, the warping that produces the time loops extends all the way out to infinity in space and back to the infinite past in time. Thus, these space-times were created with time travel in them. We have no reason to believe that our own universe was created in such a warped fashion, and we have no reliable evidence of visitors from the future. I'm discounting the conspiracy theory that UFOs are from the future and that the government knows and is covering it up. Its record of cover-ups is not that good. I shall therefore assume that there were no time loops in the distant past, or more precisely, in the past of some surface through space-time, that I shall call S. The question then is, could some advanced civilization build a time machine? That is, could it modify the space-time to the future of S, so that time loops appeared in a finite region? I say a finite region because no matter how advanced the civilization becomes, it could presumably control only a finite part of the universe. In science, finding the right formulation of a problem is often the key to solving it, and this was a good example. To define what was meant by a finite time machine, I went back to some early work of mine. Time travel is possible in a region of space-time in which there are time loops, paths that move at less than the speed of light, but which nevertheless manage to come back to the place and time they started, because of the warping of space-time. Since I've assumed that there were no time loops in the distant past, there must be what I call a time travel horizon, the boundary separating the region of time loops from the region without them. Time travel horizons are rather like black hole horizons. While a black hole horizon is formed by light rays that just miss falling into the black hole, a time travel horizon is formed by light rays on the verge of meeting up with themselves. I then take as my criterion for a time machine what I call a finitely generated horizon. That is, a horizon which is formed by light rays that all emerge from a bounded region. In other words, they don't come in from infinity or from a singularity, but originate from a finite region containing time loops, the sort of region our advanced civilization is supposed to create. In adopting this definition as the footprint of a time machine, we have the advantage of being able to use the machinery that Roger Penrose and I developed to study singularities and black holes. Even without using the Einstein equations, I can show that in general, a finitely generated horizon will contain a light ray that actually meets up with itself. That is, a light ray that keeps coming back to the same point over and over again. Each time the light came round, it would be more and more blue-shifted, so the images would get bluer and bluer. The wave crests of a pulse of light will get closer and closer together, and the light will get around in shorter and shorter intervals of its time. In fact, a particle of light would have only a finite history, as defined by its own measure of time, even though it went around and around in a finite region and didn't hit a curvature, singularity. One might not care if a particle of light completed its history in a finite time, but I can also prove that there would be paths moving at less than the speed of light that had only finite duration. These could be the histories of observers who would be trapped in a finite region before the horizon and would go around and around faster and faster until they reached the speed of light in a finite time. So, if a beautiful alien in a flying saucer invites you into her time machine, step with care. You might fall into one of these trapped repeating histories of only finite duration. These results don't depend on the Einstein equations, but only on the way space-time would have to warp to produce time loops in a finite region. However, we can now ask what kind of matter an advanced civilization would have to use to warp space-time so as to build a finite-sized time machine. Can it have positive energy density everywhere, as in the cosmic string space-time I described earlier? Cosmic string space-time didn't satisfy my requirement that the time loops appear in a finite region. However, one might think that this was just because the cosmic strings were infinitely long. One might imagine that one could build a finite time machine using finite loops of cosmic string and have the energy density positive everywhere. It's a pity to disappoint people such as Kip, who want to return to the past, but it can't be done with positive energy density everywhere. I can prove that to build a finite time machine, you need negative energy. Energy density is always positive in classical theory, so time machines of finite size are ruled out on this level. However, the situation is different in the semi-classical theory, in which one considers matter to behave according to quantum theory, but space-time to be well-defined and classical. As we've seen, the uncertainty principle of quantum theory means that fields are always fluctuating up and down, even in apparently empty space, and have an energy density that is infinite. Thus one has to subtract an infinite quantity to get the finite energy density that we observe in the universe. This subtraction can leave the energy density negative, at least locally. Even in flat space, one can find quantum states in which the energy density is negative locally, although the total energy is positive. One might wonder whether these negative values actually cause space-time to warp in the appropriate way to build a finite time machine. But it seems they must. As we saw in Chapter 4, quantum fluctuations mean that even apparently empty space is full of pairs of virtual particles that appear together, move apart, and then come back together and annihilate each other. One member of a virtual particle pair will have positive energy and the other negative energy. When a black hole is present, the negative energy member can fall in and the positive energy member can escape to infinity, where it appears as radiation that carries positive energy away from the black hole. The negative energy particles falling in cause the black hole to lose mass and to evaporate slowly, with its horizon shrinking in size. Ordinary matter with positive energy density has an attractive gravitational effect and warps space-time to bend light rays toward each other, just as the ball on the rubber sheet in Chapter 2 always makes the smaller ball bearings curve toward it, never away. This would imply that the area of the horizon of a black hole could only increase with time, never shrink. For the horizon of a black hole to shrink in size, the energy density on the horizon must be negative and warp space-time to make light rays diverge from each other. This was something I first realized when I was getting into bed soon after the birth of my daughter. I won't say how long ago that was, but I now have a grandson. The evaporation of black holes shows that on the quantum level, the energy density can sometimes be negative and warp space-time in the direction that would be needed to build a time machine. Thus, we might imagine that some very advanced civilization could arrange things so that the energy density is sufficiently negative to form a time machine that could be used by macroscopic objects, such as spaceships. However, there's an important difference between a black hole horizon, which is formed by light rays that just keep going, and the horizon in a time machine, which contains closed light rays that keep going around and around. A virtual particle moving on such a closed path will bring its ground state energy back to the same point again and again. One would therefore expect the energy density to be infinite on the horizon, the boundary of the time machine, the region in which one can travel into the past. This is borne out by explicit calculations in a few backgrounds that are simple enough for exact calculations. It would mean that a person or a space probe that tried to cross the horizon to get into the time machine would get wiped out by a bolt of radiation. So the future looks black for time travel, or should one say, blindingly white. The energy density of matter depends on the state it is in. So it is possible that an advanced civilization might be able to make the energy density finite on the boundary of the time machine by freezing out or removing the virtual particles that go around and around in a closed loop. It's not clear, however, that such a time machine would be stable. The least disturbance, such as someone crossing the horizon to enter the time machine, might set off circulating virtual particles and trigger a bolt of lightning. This is a question that physicists should be free to discuss without being laughed to scorn. Even if it turns out that time travel is impossible, it's important that we understand why it is impossible. To answer that question definitely, we need to consider quantum fluctuations, not only of matter fields, but of space-time itself. One might expect that these would cause a certain fuzziness in the paths of light rays and in the whole concept of time ordering. Indeed, one can regard the radiation from black holes as leaking out because quantum fluctuations of space-time mean that the horizon is not exactly defined. Because we don't yet have a complete theory of quantum gravity, it's difficult to say what the effects of space-time fluctuations should be. Nevertheless, we can hope to get some pointers from the Feynman sum over histories described in Chapter 3. Each history will be a curved space-time with matter fields in it. Since we're supposed to sum over all possible histories, not just those that satisfy some equations, the sum must include space-times that are warped enough for travel into the past. So the question is, why isn't time travel happening everywhere? The answer is that time travel is indeed taking place on a microscopic scale, but we don't notice it. If one applies the Feynman sum over histories idea to a particle, one has to include histories in which the particle travels faster than light and even backward in time. In particular, there will be histories in which the particle goes around and around on a closed loop in time and space. It will be like the film Groundhog Day, in which a reporter has to live the same day over and over again. One can't observe particles with such closed-loop histories directly with a particle detector. However, the indirect effects have been measured in a number of experiments. One is a small shift in the light given out by hydrogen atoms, caused by electrons moving in closed loops. Another is a small force between parallel metal plates, caused by the fact that there are slightly fewer closed-loop histories that can fit between the plates, compared to the region outside. Another equivalent interpretation of the Casimir effect. Thus, the existence of closed-loop histories is confirmed by experiment. One might dispute whether closed-loop particle histories have anything to do with the warping of space-time, because they occur even in fixed backgrounds such as flat space. But in recent years, we've found that phenomena in physics often have dual, equally valid descriptions. One can equally well say that a particle moves on a closed loop in a given fixed background, or that the particle stays fixed, and space and time fluctuate around it. It's just a question of whether you do the sum over particle paths first, and then the sum over curved spacetimes, or vice versa. It seems, therefore, that quantum theory allows time travel on a microscopic scale. However, this is not much use for science fiction purposes, such as going back and killing your grandfather. The question, therefore, is, can the probability in the sum over histories be peaked around spacetimes with macroscopic time loops? One can investigate this question by studying the sum over histories of matter fields in a series of background spacetimes that get closer and closer to admitting time loops. One would expect something dramatic to happen when time loops first appear, and this is borne out in a simple example that I studied with my student Michael Cassidy. The background spacetimes in the series we studied were closely related to what is called the Einstein universe, the spacetime that Einstein proposed when he believed that the universe was static and unchanging in time, neither expanding nor contracting. See Chapter 1. In the Einstein universe, time runs from the infinite past to the infinite future. The space directions, however, are finite and close on themselves, like the surface of the Earth, but with one more dimension. One can picture this spacetime as a cylinder with the long axis being the time direction and the cross-section being the three space directions. The Einstein universe doesn't represent the universe we live in because it's not expanding. Nevertheless, it is a convenient background to use when discussing time travel, because it's simple enough that one can do the sum over histories. Forgetting about time travel for a moment, consider matter in an Einstein universe that is rotating about some axis. If you were on the axis, you could remain at the same point of space, just as you do when standing at the center of a children's carousel. But if you were not on the axis, you would be moving through space as you rotated about the axis. The further you were from the axis, the faster you would be moving. So if the universe were infinite in space, points sufficiently far from the axis would have to be rotating faster than light. However, because the Einstein universe is finite in the space directions, there is a critical rate of rotation below which no part of the universe is rotating faster than light. Now consider the sum over particle histories in a rotating Einstein universe. When the rotation is slow, there are many paths a particle can take using a given amount of energy. Thus, the sum over all particle histories in this background gives a large amplitude. This means that the probability of this background would be high in the sum over all curved spacetime histories. That is, it's among the more probable histories. However, as the rate of rotation of the Einstein universe approaches the critical value, so that its outer edges are moving at a speed approaching the speed of light, there is only one particle path that is classically allowed on that edge, namely, one that is moving at the speed of light. This means that the sum over particle histories will be small. Thus, the probability of these backgrounds will be low in the sum over all curved spacetime histories. That is, they are the least probable. What do rotating Einstein universes have to do with time travel and time loops? The answer is that they're mathematically equivalent to other backgrounds that do admit time loops. These other backgrounds are universes that are expanding in two space directions. The universes are not expanding in the third space direction, which is periodic. That is to say, if you go a certain distance in this direction, you get back to where you started. However, each time you do a circuit of the third space direction, your speed in the first or second directions gets boosted. If the boost is small, there are no time loops. However, consider a sequence of backgrounds with increasing boosts in speed. At a certain critical boost, time loops will appear. Not surprisingly, this critical boost corresponds to the critical rate of rotation of the Einstein universes. Since the sum over histories calculations in these backgrounds are mathematically equivalent, one can conclude that the probability of these backgrounds goes to zero as they approach the warping needed for time loops. In other words, the probability of having sufficient warping for a time machine is zero. This supports what I've called the chronology protection conjecture, mentioned at the end of Chapter 2, that the laws of physics conspire to prevent time travel by macroscopic objects. Although time loops are allowed by the sum over histories, the probabilities are extremely small. Based on the duality arguments I mentioned earlier, I estimate the probability that Kip Thorne could go back and kill his grandfather as less than 1 in 10 with a trillion, 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 trillion zeros after it. As gambling men, Kip and I would bet on odds like that. The trouble is, we can't bet each other because we're now both on the same side. On the other hand, I wouldn't take a bet with anyone else. He might be from the future and know that time travel worked. You might wonder if this chapter is part of a government cover-up on time travel. You might be right. Chapter 6. Our Future. Star Trek or not? How biological and electronic life will go on developing in complexity at an ever-increasing rate. The reason Star Trek is so popular is because it's a safe and comforting vision of the future. I'm a bit of a Star Trek fan myself, so I was easily persuaded to take part in an episode in which I played poker with Newton, Einstein, and Commander Data. I beat them all, but unfortunately there was a red alert, so I never collected my winnings. Star Trek shows a society that is far in advance of ours in science, in technology, and in political organization. The last might not be difficult. There must have been great changes, with their accompanying tensions and upsets, in the time between now and then. But in the period we're shown, science, technology, and the organization of society are supposed to have achieved a level of near perfection. I want to question this picture and ask if we will ever reach a final steady state in science and technology. At no time in the 10,000 years or so since the last ice age has the human race been in a state of constant knowledge and fixed technology. There have been a few setbacks, like the Dark Ages after the fall of the Roman Empire, but the world's population, which is a measure of our technological ability to preserve life and feed ourselves, has risen steadily, with only a few hiccups, such as the Black Death. In the last 200 years, population growth has become exponential. That is, the population grows by the same percentage each year. Currently, the rate is about 1.9% a year. That may not sound like very much, but it means that the world population doubles every 40 years. Other measures of technological development in recent times are electricity consumption and the number of scientific articles. They too show exponential growth, with doubling times of less than 40 years. There's no sign that scientific and technological development will slow down and stop in the near future, certainly not by the time of Star Trek, which is supposed to be not that far in the future. But if the population growth and the increase in the consumption of electricity continue at their current rates, by 2600, the world's population will be standing shoulder to shoulder, and electricity use will make the Earth glow red hot. If you stacked all the new books being published next to each other, you would have to move at 90 miles an hour just to keep up with the end of the line. Of course, by 2600, new artistic and scientific work will come in electronic forms rather than as physical books and papers. Nevertheless, if the exponential growth continued, there would be 10 papers a second in my kind of theoretical physics, and no time to read them. Clearly, the present exponential growth can't continue indefinitely. So what will happen? One possibility is that we'll wipe ourselves out completely by some disaster, such as a nuclear war. There's a sick joke that the reason we've not been contacted by extraterrestrials is that when a civilization reaches our stage of development, it becomes unstable and destroys itself. However, I'm an optimist. I don't believe the human race has come so far just to snuff itself out when things are getting interesting. The Star Trek vision of the future, that we achieve an advanced but essentially static level, may come true in respect of our knowledge of the basic laws that govern the universe. As I shall describe in the next chapter, there may be an ultimate theory that we'll discover in the not-too-distant future. This ultimate theory, if it exists, will determine whether the Star Trek dream of warp drive can be realized. According to present ideas, we shall have to explore the galaxy in a slow and tedious manner, using spaceships traveling slower than light. But since we don't yet have a complete unified theory, we can't quite rule out warp drive. On the other hand, We already know the laws that hold in all but the most extreme situations, the laws that govern the crew of the Enterprise, if not the spaceship itself. Yet it doesn't seem that we'll ever reach a steady state in the uses we make of these laws, or in the complexity of the systems that we can produce with them. It is with this complexity that the rest of this chapter will be concerned. By far the most complex systems that we have are our own bodies. Life seems to have originated in the primordial oceans that covered the Earth 4 billion years ago. How this happened, we don't know. It may be that random collisions between atoms built up macromolecules that could reproduce themselves and assemble themselves into more complicated structures. What we do know is that by 3.5 billion years ago, the highly complicated DNA molecule had emerged. DNA is the basis for all life on Earth. It has a double helix structure, like a spiral staircase, which was discovered by Francis Crick and James Watson in the Cavendish Lab at Cambridge in 1953. The two strands of the double helix are linked by pairs of nucleic acids, like the treads in a spiral staircase. There are four kinds of nucleic acids: cytosine, guanine, tyrosine, and adenosine. The order in which the different nucleic acids occur along the spiral staircase carries the genetic information that enables the DNA molecule to assemble an organism around it and reproduce itself. As the DNA makes copies of itself, there are occasional errors in the order of the nucleic acids along the spiral. In most cases, the mistakes in copying make the DNA either unable or less likely to reproduce itself, meaning that such genetic errors or mutations, as they're called, will die out. But in a few cases, the error or mutation will increase the chances of the DNA surviving and reproducing. Such changes in the genetic code will be favored. This is how the information contained in the sequence of nucleic acids gradually evolves and increases in complexity. Because biological evolution is basically a random walk in the space of all genetic possibilities, it's been very slow. The complexity, or numbers of bits of information that is coded in DNA, is roughly the number of nucleic acids in the molecule. For the first 2 billion years or so, the rate of increase in complexity must have been of the order of one bit of information every 100 years. The rate of increase of DNA complexity gradually rose to about one bit a year over the last few million years. But then, about 6 or 8 thousand years ago, a major new development occurred. We developed written language. This meant that information could be passed from one generation to the next without having to wait for the very slow process of random mutations and natural selection to code it into the DNA sequence. The amount of complexity increased enormously. A single paperback romance could hold as much information as the difference in the DNA between apes and humans, and a 30-volume encyclopedia could describe the entire sequence of human DNA. Even more important, the information in books can be updated rapidly. The current rate at which human DNA is being updated by biological evolution is about one bit a year. But there are 200,000 new books published each year, a new information rate of over 1 million bits a second. Of course, most of this information is garbage, but even if only one bit in 1 million is useful, that is still 100,000 times faster than biological evolution. This transmission of data through external, non-biological means has led the human race to dominate the world and to have an exponentially increasing population. But now we're at the beginning of a new era in which we'll be able to increase the complexity of our internal record, the DNA, without having to wait for the slow process of biological evolution. There has been no significant change in human DNA in the last 10,000 years, but it is likely that we'll be able to completely redesign it in the next 1,000. Of course, many people will say the genetic engineering of humans should be banned, but it's doubtful we'll be able to prevent it. Genetic engineering of plants and animals will be allowed for economic reasons, and someone is bound to try it on humans. Unless we have a totalitarian world order, someone somewhere will design improved humans. Clearly, creating improved humans will create great social and political problems with respect to unimproved humans. My intention is not to defend human genetic engineering as a desirable development, but just to say it's likely to happen whether we want it or not. This is the reason why I don't believe science fiction like Star Trek, where people 400 years into the future are essentially the same as we are today. I think the human race and its DNA will increase its complexity quite rapidly. We should recognize that this is likely to happen and consider how we'll deal with it. In a way, the human race needs to improve its mental and physical qualities if it's to deal with the increasingly complex world around it and meet new challenges such as space travel. Humans also need to increase their complexity if biological systems are to keep ahead of electronic ones. At the moment, computers have the advantage of speed, but they show no sign of intelligence. And this is not surprising, because our present computers are less complex than the brain of an earthworm, a species not noted for its intellectual powers. But computers obey what is known as Moore's Law. Their speed and complexity double every 18 months. It's one of those exponential growths that clearly can't continue indefinitely. However, it will probably continue until computers have a complexity similar to that of the human brain. Some people say that computers can never show true intelligence, whatever that may be. But it seems to me that if very complicated chemical molecules can operate in humans to make them intelligent, then equally complicated electronic circuits can also make computers act in an intelligent way. And if they're intelligent, they can presumably design computers that have an even greater complexity and intelligence. Will this increase of biological and electronic complexity go on forever, or is there a natural limit? On the biological side, the limit on human intelligence up to now has been set by the size of the brain that will pass through the birth canal. Having watched my three children being born, I know how difficult it is for the head to get out. But within the next 100 years, I expect we'll be able to grow babies outside the human body, so this limitation will be removed. Ultimately, however, increases in the size of the human brain through genetic engineering will come up against the problem that the body's chemical messengers, responsible for our mental activity, are relatively slow-moving. This means that further increases in the complexity of the brain will be at the expense of speed. We can be quick-witted or very intelligent, but not both. Still, I think we can become a lot more intelligent than most of the people in Star Trek. Not that that might be difficult. Electronic circuits have the same complexity versus speed problem as the human brain. In this case, however, the signals are electrical, not chemical, and travel at the speed of light, which is much higher. Nevertheless, the speed of light is already a practical limit on the design of faster computers. One can improve the situation by making the circuits smaller, but ultimately, there'll be a limit set by the atomic nature of matter. Still, we have some way to go before we meet that barrier. Another way in which electronic circuits can increase their complexity while maintaining speed is to copy the human brain. The brain does not have a single CPU, central processing unit, that processes each command in sequence. Rather, it has millions of processors working together at the same time. Such massively parallel processing will be the future for electronic intelligence as well. Assuming we don't destroy ourselves in the next 100 years, it is likely that we'll spread out first to the planets in the solar system and then to the nearby stars. But it won't be like Star Trek or Babylon 5, with a new race of nearly human beings in almost every stellar system. The human race has been in its present form for only 2 million years, out of 15 billion years or so since the Big Bang. The biological-electronic interface. Within 2 decades, a $1,000 computer may be as complex as the human brain. Parallel processors could mimic the way our brain works and make computers act in intelligent and conscious ways. Neural implants may allow a much faster interface between the brain and computers, dissolving the distance between biological and electronic intelligence. In the near future, most business transactions will probably be made between cyber personalities via the World Wide Web. Within a decade, many of us may even choose to live a virtual existence on the net, forming cyber friendships and relationships. Our understanding of the human genome will undoubtedly create great medical advances, but it will also enable us to increase the complexity of the human DNA structure significantly. In the next few hundred years, human genetic engineering will replace biological evolution.